The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 13th of December, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Bert Monroe, Head of Business Development, and Murray Patterson, Chief Geologist for Hummingbird Resources, HUM is ticker there, and they discuss their 2019 guidance and its second set of drill results from their 2018 exploration campaign in Mali. Also on the podcast, Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals, EUZ is the ticker there, and Lawrence talks about their scoping study and the negative share price action since its release. Also on the podcast, Paul Haywood, Chief Executive Officer of Block Energy, BLOE. And Paul discusses the advanced technology they have secured for their multi-well program in Georgia. Plus, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers Superdry, Bon Marché, Thomas Cook Group, TUI Group, and PZ Cousins. Plus, as always, I have two lists, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked or most read RNSs. You can see both these lists on the front page of Vox. In fact, top tens of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Bert Monroe, Head of Business Development, and Murray Patterson, Chief Geologist for Hummingbird Resources. HUM is the ticker there. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure. Good to have you.
Hey, good morning. To speak.
Yeah, you've had some significant news out, not only today, but a couple of weeks back about guidance for 2019. And so we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, as always, Bert, I hate to assume people know exactly what you're all about, even though you've been on the podcast quite a bit. But give them a brief summary. Hummingbird Resources, what's it all about, please?
Yeah, Hummingbird's an AIM-listed gold company. We've got a producing gold mine, Yanfolila, in Mali, that's been producing all of this year, having successfully built it over the course of last year. We've also got a large development project in Liberia called Dugby, as well as a suite of other exploration licenses and a significant investment in Kora Gold, another AIM-listed exploration business.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous stuff. Okay, well, let's get into the operational update and 2019 guidance. I knew it's never always clean sailing. There's always a few bumps in the road, but you're getting through that. And take us through what you put out a couple of weeks back on this, if you could, Bert.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it goes without saying it's been a very tough couple of months for Hummingbird. And I think what we've done to get through it, I think hopefully shows our, I guess, resilience and grit to come out of the other end. I think what we announced initially about 6 weeks ago was that we would be missing guidance. And that was fundamentally because there was a crack behind the edge of the pit wall, which meant that for safety reasons, we had to stop mining below it. And that was where we were forecast to get a number of our ounces out to hit guidance through Q4. And then what we brought out more recently, 2 weeks ago, was a revised guidance showing that we'll produce obviously slightly less ounces, somewhere between 87 and 92,000 ounces this year. And the implication of the misguidance around the cost of remediation of the pit wall, as well as the forecast for 2019. So before we get into the forecast for 2019, fundamentally the result of the crack means that we've had to take some weight off the pit wall. So essentially it's like a cutback we've had to do. All of that work we are planning on doing in Q4 with maybe a little bit in January, but all of it's been factored into the Q4 AISC guidance we've given. Compounded on top of that, the public bridge about 40 kilometers from our site was damaged in flooding, and we've had to mobilize a military barge to bring in new equipment. So one of the other factors holding back our ability to hit guidance was that, for a couple of months, we were unable to bring in additional heavy fleet over the damaged public bridge. So we've now resolved that situation with the mobilization of a military barge. So we're now able to get in additional fleet, which is great. So I think, a combination of factors, unfortunately, slightly out of our control, a very heavy wet season, a public bridge being damaged in flooding, which was part of the access route to site, combining together to mean that we've unfortunately going to miss guidance. So we were due to produce around 105 to 115,000 ounces, and we've obviously guided that down to to around the 90 to 92,000 ounce mark, which is frustrating, obviously, and obviously, you know, something which has been, you know, a difficult couple of months for us to deal with. But I think looking forward, we've got a plan which is dealing with it. And I think in 2019, we're guiding 110 to 125,000 ounces of production at around an $800 ASIC. So I think hopefully what that can reassure our shareholders is that we've contained the issue, we're dealing with it in Q4, we have a clear plan and strategy to get out of it, and 2019 we're returning to good quality profitability and good strong production. So hopefully we've, you know, whilst we've faced a number of challenges, we have found solutions to overcome them, and we believe we'll be back in delivering for 2019.
Yeah, well, I've just been getting my calculator out there, and so even taking your lower estimates, I've got 87,000 ounces with $800 all in sustaining costs. That's about $34 million free cash flow there, and then 2019 is probably added another $10 million to that, so it's 44. So that's good going, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the cash flow generation in 2019 does look good, as you say. If you're, you know, if you're looking at 110,000 ounces at an 800 ASIC, yeah, the project's generating good cash. So I think we've always said it, that, you know, Jandvliet's got good grade, it's open pit mining, and it's in a good mining jurisdiction. So, you know, it's a profitable operation, albeit Q4 obviously won't be, you know, as strong as we would have hoped.
Yeah, and that's off the back of you are about 65 million. Market capitalization. Okay, let's go into these exploration results then at the Jandvliet, please, if you could. So let's go to Murray. He's the expert here.
Yeah, Justin, morning. Justin, these latest results are focused on Gonca, a deposit about 5 kilometres from the process plant. It's a fully permitted project on our licence. The drilling there was to extend mine life at the project. Gonca is a high-grade target, as we saw from the results. It's got about 15 metres at 16 grams per tonne, which has been the highlights interval there for us. Gonca contains both open pit and underground resources, and the focus of the drilling at the moment has certainly been to infill and prove up the inferred resources that were there, and we're now targeting the deeper and more higher grades underground resources. So it's really our next deposit to add into the mine plan. Mm-hmm. We'd like to think that it's going to add substantial both open pit and underground ore into the process plant, which it's mostly hard rock, so it will go well with the current oxide being mined. Our rationale or our plan is really to try and bring this through as a resource model by about February next year, and looking to have the mine planning done. So preferably by the end of quarter one, we'd aim to get a new mineable reserve out to include Gonca into the current mine plan. And then our focus really switches on to drilling out. There's another three other deposits. We have six in total with resources over them. And we're just going to go through one by one and add these into the mine plan for 2019.
Yeah, but these results are very good. And I mean, do you know what? Obviously, I'm no geologist, but I was once told by someone, I said, how do you judge a good gold grade? And they gave me a rule of thumb saying, if you get at 20 ounces, so if you've got 20 metres at 1 ounce is good, but that there's 15 metres at 16 grams, that's really good, isn't it?
Justin, it is. I'd like to say that we're proud of being able to have drilled a hole like that. You don't come across many in a geologist's lifetime at all, and I've never seen one this good. So it certainly shows that they're rare, and that does end up showing the potential of Gonca, which was an inferred resource and left alone by Goldfields. They'd done a lot of drilling at Gonca. They drilled over 47,000 metres, and we're just focusing now on infilling what we think is the most economic part of that, and trying to turn it into a mine. And that result was an infill hole, though. It wasn't a step out, but it's all open at depth, and it's only shallow drilling down to about 300 metres at this stage. So we'd like to think that we could be on the tip of an iceberg at the moment, but more drilling is required before we can substantiate that.
I think importantly, just to reiterate what Murray said at the start, is it's only 5 kilometres south of our process plant, so it's really, really close to the process plant. So in terms of bringing that pit, which is obviously within our mining permit, so fully permitted, into a mine plan in terms of infrastructure and development is very straightforward. So that's another reason it's so exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the problem you had there, you said earlier, Bert, was that because of the rainy season? Was it? Oh, what happened there?
Yeah, I think our thought is this rainy season's probably been give or take four times as heavy as it was last year. Okay. That's not an excuse. I guess it's just reality. I think our pit is one of the benefits of Yanfolila is you've got a relatively large oxide zone, so it's relatively cheap and easy to mine, and that goes down to about 50 meters, give or take. At the moment, our pit in Kamana East is 40 to 50 meters deep, so we're just getting to the bottom of that oxide zone before you get into fresh rock, so hard rock. So I think probably the combination of the fact that it was you know, a young pit, which was relatively shallow in the oxides, combined with significantly heavier than usual rainfall, probably caused a few of our issues. So I think, you know, some people say, do you see those issues continuing? I think for us, the problem will essentially solve itself as we mine deeper and we'll be in the fresh rock next rainy season. So you'll naturally have, obviously, you know, more firmer pit walls, and you won't be in that oxide zone. So I think in some ways you'll just solve the problem just by being deeper. So I think it probably was for that reason, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Marvel stuff. Okay. Well, one final thing, Bert, if someone's listening, likes the sound of this and Hummingbird, but I'm not yet following the story, given those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, I think the first one would be our 2019 guidance looks very good. 110 to 125,000 ounces at 800 ASIC delivers very good cash flow for Yanfolila. I think the second one I'd probably say is that, you know, whilst we announce that we're missing guidance, it's only by give or take 10%, but our share price has probably been hit give or take 30%. So I think that would be my second reason, not one I would have used a few months ago. And thirdly and lastly, really, is all about this press release. I think some of the drill results coming through at the moment have been excellent, second to none. And I think they reinforce the message we've tried to get across all year, is that Yanfolila will be a significantly longer mine life project, which, you know, we still firmly believe in, reinforced by these results.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Murray, Bert, thanks for chatting to me, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Justin.
Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals, EUZ ticker. Lawrence, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Do you know what? I've been away on holidays and I've been checking in, but the sheer price of Europa Metals has taken a tanking, and a lot of private investors have contacted me saying, are you getting Lawrence on the podcast? And of course, I was abroad, so I couldn't, but it's nice that you come on now. So we'll go into the reasons why we think it's taken a tanking in a bit. But as always, I don't assume, you know, people know all about it, because when a share price drops, there's a lot of attention, and some people are directed towards the story. They may not know the story. So can you just explain what Europa Metals is all about, please, Lawrence?
Certainly, we're focused on a single asset, the Charal-Lead Zinc and Silver asset in Spain. And what we're looking at doing with the announcement of our scoping study at the beginning of the week is taking that piece of work and taking this project towards production into development. And what we're looking at is a highly economically robust mine. We're looking at the high-grade centre of the resource, where we can actually build something which produces money rather than just metal.
yeah. Well, do you know what? You released the scoping study, and of course, another term for the scoping study is a pre-economic assessment. And someone did say to me, why wasn't there any economic assessment in the pre-economic assessment? And so I think that's where the anger is from private investing. There's no numbers there, and that's why the share price has taken a dive. It's down by about 50%. There's also a resource reduction. So first of all, take us into, it was sort of explained in the RNS there, but why isn't there any figures in here? Because I remember speaking to you a while back on the podcast and saying, so what we expect to see is an NPV and IRR and all this stuff, and there's none of that stuff in there. Why is that?
No, absolutely. I mean, There's none of that in the announcement, and that's absolutely what shareholders want to see. But let's just be very clear. In the full scoping study, which is a significant piece of work and is in advance of many scoping studies, I mean, it's coming up towards pre-feasibility study, we have the full economics, and we're using those on a confidential basis with groups to progress the project forward. The reason there were no numbers in the announcement was because we are ASX listed. It's our primary listing. What we have to do is submit our scoping study to the Australian Stock Exchange, who then looks at it, talks to us, looks at ASIC guidelines, ASIC, the equivalent of the FCA. And what they didn't like about it was they felt we should have had more drilling to make the resource indicated. And unfortunately, after a week's toing and froing, but listening very much to what the ASX have to say, they didn't want any of the numbers at all in the announcement. And it is disappointing. Absolutely. But we do have a very good study, and we're using it as a work tool now, which was always the intention. It's just unfortunate that we can't really use it as a tool to talk to the owners of this company, the shareholders, about how exciting Tyrrell actually is. But not a great week, I agree.
Yeah, so when did you find out then? When did you know that the ASX had this rule because you've not got enough resource in the indicator, which is a more higher confidence level of resource? When did you know about that?
Well, we know, we looked at comparisons, we knew that they like 60% in indicated of the resource, but we had a look at other scoping studies, and we believe that given the level of detail, the peer groups that we have in the scoping studies, etc., that on submitting that to the ASX, we'd be able to come up with a fairly robust model. But unfortunately, we were wrong about that, and they didn't allow us to produce that robust model. So that's what we were doing last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So who's to blame you, ASX or you?
I think we must take the blame, in actual fact. I think, we are ASX listed. We are more au fait with the UK markets where you're allowed to talk about your numbers. It's very difficult, I think, when you produce a scoping study and you basically base it on JORC assumptions with a lot of work, to then get your head round about why you can't that just then disclose that to shareholders. I think that's something we've been quite frustrated and surprised about. But at the end of the day, we've got to take responsibility. We could have applied to have the numbers put out to ASIC, but at this stage we didn't think we'd do this. We just want to get the scoping study out and start using it with groups. But these numbers will come out over time once we do more work. And but I think we must have to take responsibility for not understanding the ASX mine site. In our defense, I think if you look at scoping studies in a similar manner, there's quite a wide range of what's been disclosed, but I'm not probably going to go into that any further.
Yeah, okay, all right. And so you say these figures will come out and the project hasn't changed, it's changed a little bit. So what happened with the resource size? It's gone down from 19 million tonnes to 16 million tonnes. What happened there?
Well, I'll be blunt, that was a horrifying moment, which was literally as we confirmed. I'm just going to be blunt, that's the type of thing that should not happen. And we've got lucky, but that's not really good enough. In the closing moments of getting the scoping study finalised, an anomaly came up in the coordinates. And we thought it was worth checking, so Miles took it back to the team. And at the beginning of this year, we had a full review of all the data and the licences, etc., checking coordinates, because we knew that there was a coordinate system changed, and we thought we were fine. But it turns out that we weren't, and we ended up losing resource. And that is something which was extremely concerning right at the end of the scoping study. Now, we've been lucky in some senses because that area we're probably never going to mine anyway. It's near the river. It's narrow. We just want to concentrate on the thicker cores in the middle. But we came back from Spain last week where we've been just going through absolutely everything and also making some structural changes to the team on the ground and how we handle our data. So lucky this time, but it's the sort of thing, as an investor myself, I probably don't want to see from a mining company. I'm just going to put my hand up to that.
Okay. Well, I've got, because at the moment, what's frustrating is the share price has taken pretty much a 50% knock. And like I said, there's no figures to go off because everyone's expecting that. And then you have that, the mistake with the resource size being reduced. And so it's a massive knock. But
it's a great project, though, Justin. It remains a great project. Yes. That's the thing. And frankly, we're happier with it than we have been to date. Sorry, I'm interrupting you. But in the absolute fundamentals, we think it works really well. And we're looking forward to actually getting on and finishing off the work we need to do.
Yeah, well, you are, like I said, the share price goes down, and if the project's still the same, then obviously your company is now cheaper. You're now sub 3 million market cap. So there was a well-researched person I know, whole stock, and he sent me some figures through, he reckons, and obviously I don't know if you can confirm or deny this, but he reckons the NPV is around just shy of $200 million at 8%. Post 25% tax, and this is working off 500,000 tons mined per annum, life of mine 10 years, and this is equivalent grades at 10%. That's around 6% zinc, 4% lead. Can you comment? Is there anywhere near that?
10%. Sorry, what were the last two numbers?
So we're targeting high grade core 10%. Obviously, maybe that's a combination. I don't know, but 500,000 tons mined per annum over a life of mine of 10 years.
Okay, I mean, well, that is interesting, and do you know what? Okay, we're at 60 million tonnes now at 7%, and I would say 7% is probably the pretty much the sort of respectable lower end of which you can actually mine, so it could be doable. But what we want to look at is something much more along the lines of smaller resource mined with a much higher margin. So we love the fact that the zinc price was up at the beginning of the year, but we want a proper, robust mine that actually can be built and invested in for production. So, yeah, we think a lot about 10 million tonnes at 10%, let's call it 500,000 per annum. Tons per annum, because suddenly you start, you're not just trying to mine the entire hill, you've actually got something deliverable and it's got great margins potentially, and you've got that comfort of a grade margin, especially with the silver credit in there as well. But I can't comment on the NPV, etc., but that's quite interesting. If you look at other projects like Sarsa and Fireweed's predictions, and having a look at the type of margins that have been realised there. And some of those are quite aggressive. And we've built a lot of fat into our own internal scoping study. We think that's really interesting. Focused, tight production schedule, just looking at the high-grade areas.
Okay. That assumption there by this investor is not far off. Are you saying it's sort of in the same ballpark or what?
Depending on what it's based in, it's certainly a very interesting model if you are looking at a highly focused mining operation of around. So we've got 60 million tonnes at 7%. He's talking about, I think, was it 10 million as well at 10%. We have a look at reducing size of resource as well with the high-grade areas that we've shown in our block models before. So less tonnes, higher grade. And certainly, how much you're mining 500,000 tonnes per annum begins to look like an obvious way to go in terms of those metrics.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff. Okay. So what's the next thing now? You had drilling going on. What's the next bit of news you're hoping to get out there, Lawrence?
Well, we're dying to wait for the assays from the diamond drilling, which we drill three holes. So that's not into the high grade core. That's just filling in some areas nearer surface. But we were looking over the core last week, and we're looking forward to the assays coming back and seeing what that's come up with. We're going to start the environmental baseline study pretty sharpish, we hope, in January. So we get that rolling for 12 months. So basically what we're looking for is a nice, tight development schedule. So despite the events the last 48 hours, what we're looking at is staged work where we don't have to raise money potentially all at once, but where we can just keep work going and at the right time progress with full feasibility work. But fundamentally, you're going to see hopefully drilling results coming out for the end of the year. We're also doing mapping work because we've redone a lot of the mapping, and that's proved very interesting. And also we're still looking at some of the historic core as well. So we'll be doing that this month and in January. And then the key thing for next year is take all of that data, enhance our understanding, perhaps link some of the new data to those RC drill results that we got with that high grade result, which sort of intellectually is proving quite interesting as to what this project might be. But also I think an initial drilling program of diamond drill right down into the high grade inferred areas that we've got. So all the reds, pinks, oranges, to turn that into indicated, and also start doing meaningful metallurgical work, because the met work, we're blessed in many ways by having lots of old mines surrounding us, and that's what a lot of the met assumptions have been based on. But for lead zinc projects, especially with the silver credit, we want to prove what the recoveries are, and we want to look at that concentrate product mix, which at the moment we think is zinc with silver in the lead. And frankly, that is going to be a massive part of what this project is. And that's a key element which we're talking to a number of groups out at the moment, is really interesting.
So one final, I keep having a question coming up saying, you say it's an excellent project, but the guys there, you don't have a huge amount of skin in the game. What would make you buy stock then, Lawrence here?
Well, at this point in time, I'm just going to come back to the fact we've put a lot of work into this project. We haven't taken enormous amounts of salaries. I had this debate with a shareholder on Monday when we presented to Europa shareholders at TPI Vox presentation. At this moment in time, we honestly think we've put an awful lot of hard work in this, and we're going to make money off the options, not the salary. And that's the upside for the directors. And we represent probably one of the sole biggest shareholders of Europa, who's our chairman. So I think we're aligned with shareholders at the moment. And honestly, what would you prefer? Would you prefer somebody on £180,000-£200,000 putting £10,000-£20,000 shares into the company, or somebody who's on significantly low, below £100,000, actually aligned through share options, working quite hard to deliver an outcome?
Okay, Lawrence, one final thing. If someone's listening to this and think there's an advantage to be taken here in the drop in the share price, three reasons why they should add to their watch list Europa Metals, please.
You've got a capex of 3 million with a 16 million ton, 7% zinc equivalent resource with silver going into feasibility.
Excellent.
And that's it. And there aren't many of them, and it's in Spain.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff, Lawrence. Thanks for coming on, brother. And hopefully. you okay there? You can survive.
Sorry, just try not to cough through the interview.
hopefully we'll speak again soon. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Haywood, Chief Executive Officer at Block Energy, BLOE. There's a ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me again.
No problem, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, for people not familiar with the company or just new to the podcast and giving it a try out, could you explain Block Energy? What is it all about, please?
Sure, no problem at all. So we are an EMP company with an immediate focus on the Republic of Georgia. We are a party to three production sharing contracts. We have 100% working interest in Norio, 90% working interest in Satskinesi, and we are farming in for a 75% working interest in West Rastavi. We are newly listed on AIM, having raised £5 million back in June this year, and we are fully funded to execute our first phase of work that is currently ongoing.
Excellent stuff. So it's all action in the action part of the game here. And you've announced recently, or I say recently, it's got days ago, advanced completion workover technology secured for multi-well program in Georgia. So what's this about? What is this tech? What does it do?
Sure. But Justin, there's phase one of our work program is performing a bunch of re-entries into existing wells located in our Norio oil field position. Basically, this is an oil enhancement process, and the tool that's been identified is a micro drilling tool, and it enables us to mitigate one of the key risks that we've identified throughout the Norio program, or at least this re-entry program, and that is bypassing existing wellbore damage. So a lot of these wells that we're planning to recomplete were drilled back in the early Soviet times, and they wasn't always drilled in the best possible way, and therefore the reservoirs of interest sustained some pretty significant damage, which in turn creates issues around your production flow. So what's most important when performing these re-entries is ensuring that you're able to break out of the existing skin damage around the reservoir and penetrate fresh virgin reservoir, and therefore increase production. So the tool that we're bringing, that we have now brought in, actually, we sourced it from North America, has arrived in Georgia. We mobilized it to site yesterday, and we have got several wells prepared awaiting the tool. So we're actually performing our first perforation this evening, and it'll run into tomorrow morning, and that will then be followed by two wells being utilized, utilizing this tool in two additional wells. So we spent the better part of several months preparing locations, getting the civil works done, sorting out all the permits, mobilizing people and kit from all over the world, and everything has now landed in Georgia, and we are well set to execute the most exciting part of our work program. So it's very busy times for all.
Yeah, and I suppose points of interest here is that, first of all, it's, like you said, it's a proven technology in North America. And secondly, you've signed a heads of terms agreement, so you can sort of take a cut of the action if it's successful. Is that right?
Yeah, you're spot on, Justin. It's a bit of an entrepreneurial move on our part, actually. And we thought, well, look, you know, OK, this tool's been proven in North America, and that's where, you know, head office is for the technology providers and their immediate area of focus. So coming over to, you know, Eastern Europe, Central Asia has never really been on the radar. But, you know, it was our thought internally that, look, if we're going to mobilize this tool over to Georgia and we're going to prove it in Georgia and potentially open up a larger larger business opportunity for the holders of the technology, then, you know, it's only right that our shareholders share in some of that action. So we've negotiated an overriding royalty on all revenue generated from an area of interest, Georgia, of course, being a key part to that area. But if you go through the announcement, you can see that we've negotiated, you know, the lion's share of Eastern Europe, Russia, and select parts of the Middle East. Actually, not that Middle East is on our radar right now, but most definitely areas in and around Georgia, and more importantly, Georgia specifically, there is a hell of a lot of opportunity for this tool and technology. And if we prove it in this up and coming work program, it offers the company a significant opportunity to A, leverage the exclusive rights over the technology when negotiating additional farm-ins and asset acquisitions, and also ensure that any other business that comes through from the region that's not directly tied to Block Energy, Block shareholders share in that upside. So it's a good deal all around. Very pleased to be working with the technology providers. They are oil men through and through, and Block has actually brought an interesting commercial element to to broaden in the horizons for them for the technology. So it's panning out extremely well.
Yeah, because let's be honest, you've already sort of paid to use it. So it's, from now, it's no risk for you. If it's a success, you get sort of plenty of reward from it as well. So that's quite exciting. So just take us through, Paul. So what are you hoping to do between now and, say, let's say quarter one of 2019? What are you hoping to do, and what upside potential is there?
Yeah, you've given me more time than I was expecting there, Justin. But I'll just look at over the shorter term, so just before Christmas, we're expecting to have at least 3 recompletions done, possibly one more. We're running this tool into 2 wells, and then we are also, as I mentioned earlier, we're perforating 2 wells, which is technology that's standard to this region. So we'll sit back, we'll analyse those results, and we've got 4 more wells planned for re-entries, and we'll then take a view on whether we continue to run the this new tool from North America, or we continue with the perforations. There's going to be a bit of a study process over the Christmas period whilst everybody's enjoying themselves with family and whatnot. And moving into Q1 next year, we've just rigged up our ZJ40 rig in West Rastavi on our first re-entry candidate. A more detailed update is expected out to be released to the market shortly, and so I won't go into too much detail on what's going on over there. But West Rastavi is looking extremely exciting for us. That's obviously the jewel in the crown with regards to our work program. And again, we've completed all the civil works over in West Rastavi. The a well site location has been finalised. We've now rigged up on site. All guys are now in country that are going to be managing that work program, and we're expecting a spud date in and around early January next year for our first major West Rastavi sidetrack. So an announcement will be following on West Rastavi shortly, and there'll be more detail for our followers to dig through then.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. One final thing, Paul, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing here and the news flow ahead, but are not following the company as yet, give them the 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, so look, we're doing new things in Georgia. We're being extremely creative, and we like to feel innovative with our approach to certain risks that are apparent here. So, I'd expect some interesting, we're producing some fantastic content for our followers to read through. So an exciting one to follow from that standpoint. We are in one of the most juiciest parts of a work program right now. So there's an obscene amount of activity ongoing. So lots to follow there, which is great. And look, we're fully funded to execute our phase one program, as continuously stated throughout this year. And look, we really are expecting some exciting news over the coming periods, moving into kind of Q1 2019. So lots of reasons to keep an eye on us, Justin.
Marvellous stuff, Paul. Thanks for that. And hopefully, I know you've got lots going on, so hopefully we'll be catching up again in not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You're right, Chris.
Yeah, very good, Justin. Very good. Thank you very much.
Do you know what? I saw it, minus we've chatted about it before, Superdry. They've fallen magnificently over the last couple of days. Was it interims or finals they had out? I can't remember.
I think it was a disaster. I don't think it really mattered what they were doing. I love Superdry
interims,
in the sense that interims, that's right. And I love Superdry, not because I would, unlike you, Justin, I know, have any of their clothes, but because I came across the wonderful description as the faux Japanese retailer in the press yesterday, which I thought was fantastic. What a shocker there, my goodness. I mean, it's just a perfect storm, isn't it? You've not only got a fashion miss, or the fact that the weather's been not right for their sort of range of jackets and fleeces and other faux Japanese stuff that they sell, but you've got the co-founder agitating and has been agitating for months on end about about the change of strategy, how it's all gone wrong. And my goodness, has he been right? You know, shocking numbers there and a big old share price fall. However, did you note that they did say that the dividend would be maintained, which I thought was interesting. If I recall, it's got sort of cash on the balance sheet, or at least basically no debt on the balance sheet, which again is no disaster. So I'm wondering whether it's a contrarian buy here. And I'll tell you why, because I think the co-founder might be so hacked off that he might be talking about some private equity boys to try to see whether they can, you know, take it over or take it off the market or whatever else. He does own about 18% of the business, if I recall. So, you know, watch this space, I would say. The shares I see on the sort of the day after the flood, if you like, are slightly up, which you would expect given the magnitude of the fall. But one, I don't have a position in or anything, but it is interesting me at these levels, I must admit, even though I don't own any of their clothes.
Well, I did accidentally too many of their clothes, because, you know, I hate clothes shopping. My wife will do everything for me if she can, and she'll find something I quite like once, I'll say yes to, and then she'll go overboard and go crazy. And so I've got about four hoodies and about 10, and I've got the stage now where I hate them. I just genuinely hate them. And I think that's what most people, what happened, because I saw it recently. I read that apparently, I don't know where it was, somewhere today, that the problem is in their catalogues and their pictures and their advertising, young people were in this brand, but essentially, I think Financial Times called it cool dads, which is not a good thing for teenagers. Don't want to be seeing cool dads. And the thing is, I even felt old being described as a cool dad, and I thought, that's not cool. And I don't like the massive branding on the front. I don't know why I liked it in the first place. It's got the stage where I said to my wife, I want the opposite of this. I don't want any branding on my T-shirts or shirts. I want as little branding as possible. You know, I don't want to be a walking billboard for Super Dry. It's just a bit crass and over the top. So I'm really starting to hate them. I quite like them aside. I hate them now, you know?
Well, I'm not sure where you stand with something like a French Connection, but you recall, and I won't say it for reasons of prudence, what the famous, of course, French Connection sort of marketing strategy was, an allusion to a somewhat rude word. But, you know, again, that kind of had that wonderful trip up, didn't it? It was very much in fashion, and then it fell like a stone, and they've never really recovered from that, because they've lost their kind of their angle, their thing, and, you know, what really replaces it. But we'll see. But clearly difficult times on the high street. And I was looking at a company I don't know too much about, Bon Marché, you know, wonderful name. But, you know, when you look at their statement today, I think the shares are off 40-odd%. They're talking about unprecedented trading conditions on the UK high street. They need a mega last sort of couple of weeks of the Christmas trading period to make their numbers. And obviously the market's sold the shares first and is going to ask the questions later. But clearly not easy. And, I guess, you know, political angst and whatever else is not a particular helpful aspect to that. But yeah, if you don't get your strategy bang on, I'm afraid in the retail space it's not easy.
No, I know, even if it is bang on, it's a struggle at the moment. Cool. Anything else up there, Chris?
Well, let's sort of spin out from sort of consumer spending into sort of another aspect, which has been travel and leisure. And I've actually, a couple of weeks ago, obviously Thomas Cook had their disaster update, it seemed, certainly the way the market reacted to it, because of course it had that combination of, not only did they disappoint the market again, they sort of bogged it up. They admitted that things like the hot summer in the UK had helped staycations rather than Thomas Cook branded holidays. But obviously with travel companies, and people remember with Thomas Cook a few years back, had a shocker with the balance sheet, nearly went bust. People worry about what the balance sheet is going to look like. I actually think Thomas Cook is a buy, because I think people have worried too much about it. I don't think the balance sheet is really that stretched, but, you know, we'll have to see over the next few months. But a little bit of, and the reason why shares are up as I look today for Thomas Cook, up quite pleasantly, sort of 5-7%, is because their great peer TUI, which is sort of a kind of an Anglo-German company, I think they had Thompson in the UK, and TUI was obviously more the German brand. The Germans have taken it over fully, branded it accordingly, and why not? You want pan-European branding with holidays. And TUI numbers were pretty good. 10% earnings growth this year, 2018. 10% anticipated earnings growth next year. You can't complain about that. You know, people can get their heads around that. Quite correctly, TUI shares which kind of fell a bit in sympathy with Thomas Cook, are up nicely today. Good luck to them, I say. So I think the read-through, though, is for the value kind of opportunistic investor, Thomas Cook. I mean, the chart looks absolutely all over the place. But my observation would be it does seem to be picking up some support in the lower 30s, and I do see value here. So fingers crossed on Thomas Cook. I think a good read-through from TUI today.
But you know what? My wife has already booked a holiday for summer, and it's through Thomas Cook. And she asked me, she always says, what are they like? Cause I mean, she's quite wary of holiday companies, and you know, they've been in the press, haven't they, of late? And I said, I think they're okay. I said, but you know, I'm going to book insurance. So we've got insurance. So if they go through anyway, we're guaranteed a holiday. But it comes to something when you've got to do that, isn't it? But do you know what? I genuinely think I'm always a bit wary, as you are, we all know, of companies that, have a sort of a warning because of the weather, whether it's fashion or whether it's holidays. But let's be honest. When I went away last summer, I did feel a bit cheated because it was a heat wave in this country. Went to Turkey, it was a little bit hotter, but what I want to do is go away when it's raining in this country and then go to somewhere sunny, you know? And I think a lot of last-minute holidays happen that way because the weather is so miserable during the summer months generally, then people do get away and do last-minute things, don't they? And that was exceptional last year, you know? People would stay in this country, wouldn't they, you know?
That's right. No, I had a great time in Wales. A place obviously you know very well with wonderful weather, which obviously you probably don't know very well in Wales. But
the amount of times I've gone over the Severn Bridge and it's gone from sun to rain, it's unbelievable.
Absolutely. No, it was wondrous. And, you know, probably go back again next year because, you know, you extrapolate and you think, my goodness, this is it. Regime shift in the UK weather or something. But yeah. And Thomas Cook obviously has also come under a bit of criticism. There have been a few incidents with their some of their hotels, specific incidents and whatever. But also from a strategic perspective, TUI has got a bit more into things like cruise ships. It's been more overt in terms of its use of its own airline fleet and stuff like that. Thomas Cook has sort of had a bit more of a pick and mix kind of approach, and clearly that can be, as you say, because people have to be a bit more responsive, or maybe just say, you know, on the spur of the moment, do something that can impact them. But I generally do think Thomas Cook shares are cheap here, and as I say, I took a good read through from TUI, and I come back again to research, which suggests that pretty much the last thing that people will stop spending on is their holiday, because I guess they take the view if they're working for 48 or 50 weeks flat out a year, they want their 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever they're lucky to get in a Turkey or a southern Spain or some island somewhere or whatever it might be, or even Wales in the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like I said, they've taken a massive hit, but we'll see if it recovers. Cool. Anything else there, Chris?
Well, okay. Final one. To kind of go from sort of Europe and thinking like that, thinking about Africa particularly, is PZ Cousins. Now, PZ Cousins, well-known name. We've all probably got some Imperial Leather or Saint-Tropez fake tan or something like that in the bathroom somewhere. And so some good brands, you know, and some nice businesses and things like hygiene and fake tan and whatever. These are growth areas inherently. PZ Cousins, FTSE 250 name, funny old heritage, Anglo-Greek heritage, but actually a pretty savvy and sensible company. Its main differentiating aspect is its outsized exposure to Nigeria. This is for various historic reasons, but actually, if you think about it, Nigeria, in theory, massive burgeoning population, potential consumer giant, you know, that could be a very good sort of orientation. The trouble is Nigerian economy has been under a bit of pressure. So all the good work they've been doing in Europe, the States, Asia, with those brands and others, has kind of been offset a bit by the Nigerian malaise. Today's statement is sort of very reflective of that, kind of rest of the world doing good, Nigeria still very uncertain. I see the shares are down a little bit on that news today. However, two bits of good news, I think, and the reason I like this stock is because, number one, they do pay a 5% odd dividend yield. Number two, they have confirmed today that their debt level, which wasn't that excessive in any case, but interestingly, their debt level is going to be lower at the end of this year than it was at the end of last year, which I think is a good sign, because even if they're paying at a 5% divvy, they can still lower the debt that's not too bad at all. That shows good inherent cash flow generation. I think they're savvy. I think they're experienced in operating in some excitable markets like Nigeria. And for me, it looks cheap versus the range of other kind of big consumer staple names out there where I don't see much value, the Unilevers and whatever of this world. So for me, PZ Cousins, funny old name, maybe a bit of a funny company, great brands, and kind of some interesting exposures. So I must admit, I look at today's fall and I think to myself, I like it here in the sort of the sort of circa 210 pence area. So I am a buyer of this one, and I might even be a user of their products, but obviously not the Saint-Tropez fake tan, because I don't need that because I go to Wales on holiday.
Exactly. The sun is glorious. The Wales, in fact, that's what you pay for when you go across the toll bridge, you pay for the weather.
Absolutely.
Yeah, do you know what? It's funny to see at the moment. They've sort of broken below a support level. I mean, they did seem to bounce off. They're at 220, and now they're down to 2. Oh, they bounced back up today. They opened a lot lower. They opened 205. They bounced back up to 211. It'd be interesting to see if they can get back to sort of 215, 213, because that's...
Yes.
That's where they bounced off before, but not, it's a lower range there, I think. But,
that's right. You know, there has certainly been a range recently between sort of circa, say, lower 200s to about 240. So it's been a bit range bound, but I like the yield. I like the products. And ultimately, you know, do you think that Nigeria is going to be a mega economy? And the reality is that the government there may still bog things up, but just the sheer number of consumers will drive that economy forward. And my feeling is, if clearly things like the energy sector has been quite influential there as well, I do like that exposure medium term. So I have to say, when I put all the pieces together, I think this one's a good one, and I would buy the shares here.
Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris, and we'll catch up next week.
Sounds a plan. See you then.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Rose Petroleum, ROSE. At four, Botswana Diamonds, BOD. At three, GCM Resources. At two, Oilex, OEX. And number one most followed company is Superdry. Obviously, a massive fall in the last few days on the interim results, and I talk about those with Chris Bailey on today's podcast. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows: at five, Infrastrata, exercise of warrants and total voting rights. At four, Fast Forward Innovations, half year report. At three, Hummingbird Resources, exploration results update. Of course, I talked to Bert and Murray on today's podcast. At two, IQAI, Stone Checker 510K update. Number one most liked RNS came from Highland Natural Resources interim results. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.